interview with General Hamilton Twitchell by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on April 1, 1988. The interview is part of a joint project by the Columbia University Oral History Research Office and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
General Twitchell, I thought we'd start with some background questions first. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Portland, Maine. However, I was raised in a number of places. Portland, initially Portland, then Colorado, Arizona. I went to Kemper Military School and high school and junior college in West Point. I ended at West Point 31. Is this picking up all right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I graduated in 35.
What were your major fields of studies at West Point?
Well, basically, it was a Bachelor of Science course. There weren't any electives at that time. So you took math, English, history, French, Spanish, law, chemistry, physics, engineering, political science subjects.
The whole range of
them.
Yeah.
But primarily it was devoted towards a BS course.
Okay. And what was your first assignment after graduating from West Point?
I went to Governor's Island to Fort Jay, which is where the 16th Infantry was stationed.
And what would you, what did you, what was your assignment involve, I guess?
It was initially a platoon leader, and then I commanded, at that time the Army was very, very austere footing. And at one time, I guess I commanded two companies at least in name. I also served for a short time with the WPA project, working with a quartermaster at Governor's Island. I stayed at Governor's Island from 35 to spring of 37, 36. No, wait, it's 37.
And then you went to
Hawaii. While I was at Governor's Island, I took some courses at Columbia University.
In what area?
Primarily I would say business administration.
And what were you assigned to do in Hawaii?
I went there and we came home in 39. I first went to a regiment, the Hawaiian Division, and then I went to the Military Police Company. Spent about a year and 8 months.
And where did you serve during World War II?
Well, when war broke out, I was in an anti-tank battalion at Fort Benning. And as a matter of fact, I was going to Fort Leavenworth for a short course the day after I left Benning temporarily to go to Fort Leavenworth for Command and General Staff School of Course. Came back, joined the battalion, was ordered to the infantry school as an instructor for, I guess, I was there for several, maybe 5 or 6 months. And then I was ordered to the Pentagon on temporary duty. At that time, the Pentagon was just opening up. The Army initiated a course or a program to develop younger staff officers. So I was in what was called the Task Force Staff Officers Pool. We spent about 6 weeks in the course, then we moved out. We ported overseas temporarily. I went to Puerto Rico for as a member of the team, was there a month, came back, was assigned to a job in the operations division in connection with shipments of people overseas for the landing in North Africa. From there I went to Cairo for this was at the end of '42, where I was stationed in the headquarters U.S. Army in the Middle East for about 2 months. Right after the Casablanca conference, I went to, I was ordered to Europe, to London, to the operations division in the theater headquarters, the ETO headquarters. And I guess I stayed there for several months, and then I was ordered to the planning staff, which was set up for the invasion of Europe. And that was a small British-American planning staff called COSAC, which was Chief of Staff, Supreme Allied Commander Designate. I stayed there, and I actually remained in pretty much that job for until General Eisenhower came to England and took over his command Supreme Headquarters, which he activated, and I remained in the Operations Division throughout the European campaign.
So you remained in London?
No, we went from London to the Cotentin Peninsula, to Paris, to another headquarters in France, and then on into Germany and France.
Were you in the D-Day landing, or?
No, I was still in the SHAPE headquarters.
Okay. When we first talked about the interview, you said that you were in Iran very briefly during the war.
During the time I was in Cairo, we made a trip to Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Lebanon, Iran, and at that time the outlook in Iran was completely different than it was when I went back to '62. The outer ends of the city were what are now the middle of the city.
That's Tehran.
Yeah.
What did this mission involve, generally?
Well, the Middle East headquarters was in Cairo, and the chief of staff took us on a tour that he was making up to places where we had representatives or had an interest between ourselves and the British, for example.
Okay. But you were just there very briefly.
Yes.
Now, did you, I think after the war you were at Plants and Operations in the Army Department, is that right?
In August of 45, I left Europe and came back to the Operations Division in the Army Staff, where I stayed until 47, when the Joint Staff was set up under the Unification Act. I was assigned to the Joint Staff for a couple of years, but part of that time I was working on as an assistant to General Lemnitzer as the head of the Foreign Military Assistance Program, and this office was in the Office of the Secretary.
So you
I stayed there until 1950, when I was ordered to Europe.
According to the information I've seen, you worked with the Joint Strategic Plans Group for a while.
Yes.
Around 48 or so.
Well, I was I was in all of 47 until until sometime in 49.
What did that work involve?
Well, we just did we did a variety of studies and reports on planning matters, political military issues. I personally was involved in some of the planning on with regard to U.S. assistance to Western Europe before NATO was set up, and also the NATO involved in NATO planning, the planning for our joining NATO.
Did this involve any work on war plans or anything along that line? Or?
The general strategic plan, but we didn't focus primarily on the specific war plan. That was in another section.
Oh, I see. Okay. Now, when you were working with Lemnister, he was assistant to Secretary of Defense Louis Johnson. Is that?
Well, initially it was Ralph Forrestal.
Oh, Secretary. Forrestal.
And then when Forrestal committed suicide, he was replaced by Louis Johnson.
Mm-hmm. And you worked with out of that office through 1950, is that?
Yeah, I would say August 15.
Yeah. Did you participate in any of the work related to NSC 68? Either the initial study or the follow-up studies?
I didn't participate in it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And after 1950, where were you assigned?
I became a regimental executive officer in the 16th Infantry, which was in the 1st Division.
This is in the United States or?
In Europe.
Where were they stationed in Europe, though?
Schaffenberg, which was east of Frankfurt.
And I guess after that you went to SHAPE, is that correct?
Yeah.
And what were you doing?
I was a member of the staff of the Office of the Special Assistant to the Chief of Staff.
Who was the Special Assistant?
His name was Schuyler, General Court Schuyler.
Did you do work on questions involving European rearmament or German rearmament or?
Well, basically on matters affecting U.S. participation in NATO or in particular Allied Command Europe, and particularly our military assistance program, other special studies that were directed to the office by the Chief of Staff.
Did you do any work on the Pleasant Plan involving German rearmament in the context of a European army?
No, that was they had a special group set up for that. And again, though, this would relate to the whole question at that stage was the question about whether Germany was going to enter, under what conditions, and so on. Mm-hmm. And it really hadn't gotten down in some of the specifics. It was a factor in our general assessments and planning.
Can you talk briefly about what kind of considerations shaped the push for a European military buildup? How great was the concern about a Soviet military attack on Western Europe? Was that seen as a real?
Well, I think you have to couch it in these terms.
Yeah.
I think it was generally accepted by Western analysts that with the presence of some 25 to 30 Soviet divisions remaining in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe, some of which were in Germany, in contrast to the limited forces which were available in Western Europe. We, the U.S., had just a division and a constabulary, for example, until the Korean War. And I think, if I remember correctly, depending on what time, you're talking about 10 or 12 divisions in Western Europe, Allied and so on. And they, of course, the Allied divisions were not well equipped. Now, the situation with regard to the Soviets invading Czechoslovakia, the Berlin crisis, created a climate of concern about what the Soviet intentions were. And the general estimate was that they could overrun Europe very quickly, and there was very little we could do about it. And basically what had happened in the United States, you see, we had gone through a pell-mell demobilization, not only in terms of reducing forces, but the forces that were remained were in bad shape in terms of manning, cohesion, and so on. The Soviets demobilized somewhat, but not a significant degree.
Yeah, it's my impression from reading about this period is that there was more concern probably about an accidental war triggered by diplomatic miscalculations rather than a deliberate attack on the West. Does that sound
plausible? Well, I think.
Yeah.
I think that there was a recognition belatedly. Well, let's go back. I think it's particularly significant that during the latter part of World War II, I think Roosevelt in particular thought that this would be an opportunity to show the Soviets that there could be cooperation with the West. Churchill didn't agree with that concept. It became very clear during the latter part of the war, the entry into Berlin and so on, that there were going to be problems. There'd be much criticism of whether or not we should have stopped where we did on the Elbe. I remember during some of the planning in Shape, which is the World War headquarters, that we felt that there should be, as far as the entry segments of responsibility for Berlin, that there should be wedges, so that you would go in through your own territory, French, British, Germans, French, British, Americans, Russians, rather than having the Soviets being able to block our entry. But that was, again, in that kind of, wishful thinking or unrealistic thinking about our relations with the Soviets.
Okay. Now, from Shape, and I guess I was in Paris? What was your, where did you go next in the
night? I went to the National War College for a year, 53 to 54.
And from there you were?
I went to a regimental combat team in Fort Devens, Mass. For briefly a year. And I came back to Pentagon.
I guess you worked at the International Security Affairs offices during that period?
Yeah. Primarily, initially, in connection with our various treaty commitments, NATO, CETO, and CENTO. Then shortly after I got there, I guess maybe months after or certainly within a year, I took over the NATO affairs office and spent from 54 to 59 maybe. Oh, 58. I spent my time in ISA till 58, primarily on, basically all the way through, primarily on NATO affairs, all through the first year, somewhat on CENTO and CETO.
I guess at one point you were chief of the ISA's Office of International, Special International Affairs.
I think that's what they call that first group there, but primarily it dealt with our commitments and the military aspects of our commitment to the CENTO organization as well as NATO.
Okay. Did you take part in any of the discussions or decisions that were made on the role of as a tactical nuclear weapons in NATO strategy? Is that?
Well, our office was a focal point, primarily on all NATO affairs involving the Pentagon or political military affairs involving state and defense. So that we were involved in the considerations leading up to the decision on it and on how you implement it.
Okay. I guess later in the decade you were chief of the coordination group.
Yes.
At the Army Chief of Staff Office.
Right.
What were the purposes of the coordination group?
That group was had the basic task of doing special projects for the Chief of Staff and the Vice Chief. We did primarily those things which the two principals decided that they wanted studied, reports on something, comments on certain studies that would come up through the staff and so on.
Do you recall any of the projects you worked on in particular? Or?
Well, among the duties were we drafted what were called a posture statement, for example, for the Secretary and Chief of Staff on where the Army stood in connection with each congressional presentation for budgetary purposes. We did some conceptual thinking regarding the relationship between strategy and weapons development, need for the strategic planners to be out ahead of and giving some guidance to the people who are developing weapons as, rather than vice versa. The comparison of forces between the Soviets and ourselves, both in terms of weapons, manpower, organization.
After the coordination group, what?
Went down to the joint staff and the joint strategic plans group. Oh, no, I'm sorry, that's Crow. After the coordination group, I went to Korea as assistant division commander of the 1st Cavalry.
So this is late, I guess in the late 50s, right?
I went to Korea and I left here the day after Kennedy was sworn in, that close, January 21st, I think. Uh-huh. And I was out there until April of 62.
And then what? You came back to the United States?
I came back to the United States and was ordered to the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff Operations. However, I don't think I ever did a day's duty on that assignment because I was then ordered, I guess sometime in late April or May, to head a team to go to Iran to survey Iran's equipment needs in connection with the military assistance program.
I guess around that time, the Shah had already visited Washington.
Yeah, it was a fallout of his visit to Washington in the spring of 62, the commitment on the part of the U.S. to send a team out there and make a survey.
Did you talk to any of the higher-ups about the survey, McNamara or Paul Nitze? Or?
No, I talked primarily with the Assistant Secretary of Defense. At that time was Bundy.
Oh, we in Bundy?
Yeah. And the team went out under the supervision of the Joint Chiefs. So our specific directive, as well as a director from the ISA, was through the chiefs, and I dealt primarily with, for example, I talked to the chairman about this, and I talked to the limited service man. And I've forgotten who we debriefed when we came back, but... And our report was submitted to the chief, there to McNamara, and then eventually approved, I guess, eventually approved by the president.
What was your survey supposed to accomplish? What were your stated responsibilities?
Well, we were
before you left for Iran
to review the Iranian military situation. The Shah came back here asking for equipment. There was some question about the amount he wanted. There was concern over the over the force structure that he had. So we had to look at not only the strategic, but the situation as the Iranians saw their defense needs, and as how as the extent to which we saw them. And then secondly, the ability of the what they needed and the ability to absorb it. That's a very simple explanation.
Now, you left for Tehran in April 62, or about?
Well, I think after we were set up, we were here for about 3 weeks, reading ourselves into the problem. And I think we went out either late April or very early May. I stayed out there, I guess maybe 6 weeks or so.
At that time, how would you... describe the major purposes or purpose of the U.S. military aid program for Iran?
Well, I think it was in terms primarily of the threats which the Shah felt, one, the Soviets, two, his concern over the radical Arabs. He'd also been concerned about Nasser at that in that period. So basically the problem was to see just what was really needed as we perceived it, as well as what the Shah perceived, and then make some judgment on it. It also tied in, of course, with Iran being a member of the Central World at that time, the Baghdad Pact.
Now, was internal security a major consideration? The Shah's internal security in terms of planning military assistance? Or?
It was not a major consideration. I think that probably it manifested itself more in terms of the location of certain units in the capital in case something happened, but we weren't dealing with internal security in terms of providing equipment specifically or primarily for that purpose. In that regard, I think you have to understand that the police function, they have a national police, and then secondly, you had the gendarmes who were concerned more with the problems in the outer areas and in the border places and so on. Now, in terms of the gendarmes, there was a special advisory group there which dealt with those aspects.
This is a U.S. Army advisory group?
Yes. Called GenNation. Into consideration then and again later on was that the relationship between the equipment requirements of the Army and the gendarmerie.
Okay. At this point in time, around this point in time, what made Iran important policymakers in the Kennedy administration? How do they define I look at you as
well. I think primarily it was in terms of the importance of the northern tier. Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan. There, of course, there were the concerns about the radical Arabs, and particularly on the part of the Shah. And, as I mentioned earlier, Nasser. And, again, there was concern about the eastern flank of Iran, particularly if a war should break out between Pakistan and India. I don't remember whether at this time he had adopted the two-dynasty concept, but in other words, an all-around 360-degree concept. But in the 60s there, and particularly I think after problems with the Indian Pakistani war, when he became concerned, this was later than 62, over the U.S. commitment.
Okay. Now, how were the petroleum reserves of the region factored into the assumptions about security interests?
As far as our particular study was in there, we didn't get into that.
Yeah.
You know, at that time, the United States wasn't too concerned about it. Although we certainly, from World War II, or certainly during World War II, at the end of World War II, we were concerned about the availability of oil in the Gulf.
I guess for Western Europe, partly.
For Western Europe, yeah.
I know that during the post-war period, the U.S. had listening posts in northern Iran to pick up intelligence information, the missile tests and so forth, the Soviet Union. Were those already there by the early 60s?
By the late 60s?
Early 60s.
I think so, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Certainly there are some there by the late 60s.
Yeah. Now, how was the Shah regarded in Washington around this time? I read that the Kennedy administration was fairly critical of the Shah, but what was your impression?
Well, I think that permeated, I think that permeated the administration's views. As far as my immediate aspects were concerned, they were concerned about the harshness of his regime as they saw it, and they desired to press on the need for a more enlightened regime in terms of human rights, the fact that he was pretty much isolated in terms of the country as a whole, as a very small group.
I mean, political power was
concentrated, surely.
Yeah.
All of the decisions came down, everything came down from the top, and there was no real participation politically throughout the country.
Now, when you went to Tehran, I guess, in spring of 62, who traveled with you? Did you have a group of people that worked with you, or?
There was a joint team. One naval officer, three Army, one Air Force officer, and myself.
Mm-hmm. who did you meet after you arrived? Did you meet with the Shah or the ambassador? Or?
Well, we were... We worked directly with the chief of the MAG. And of course, we met the ambassador. Julius Holmes was in Washington at that time, although I saw him before I went out. So we met with the deputy chief, Stuart Rockwell, and I worked through him on any aspects.
Who was the chief?
I'm sorry?
Go ahead, Ben.
The chief on Amish MAG was Hayden.
Can you call his first name?
I would have to look it up.
Yeah. Now, did you met with the Shah also?
Met with him when I first, shortly after I arrived and just before I left.
Did he discuss his foreign policy goals or his conception of his security needs with you? And
not too much. Somewhat at that stage, but briefly outlined it, but primarily I worked with the chief of the Supreme Commander Staff on that.
Do you recall who that was? Or?
General Hedgesley.
What were your impressions of the Iranian military around this time, 1962? What was your assessment of its strengths and weaknesses, I guess?
Well, basically, they were equipped with World War II equipment. And generally speaking, the Air Force, which was the youngest of the three services, it was a more modern thinking force, even though it didn't have much equipment. The Navy didn't have had very little ships because of the results of the sinkings of the ships during World War II. And the Army reflected, as I just mentioned, primarily World War II thinking because of the equipment and so on. And it was evident that if they were going to move towards more sophisticated equipment, it was a major problem, not only in terms of training the Iranians to use the equipment, to be able to maintain it, but also to change the thinking of the Iranian military, let's say to advance the thinking of the military in terms of modern warfare and particularly joint warfare. So my impression was that the level of equipment, my impression was, or my feeling was, that what they would need to carry out the Shah's concept of defense was one thing. What they could handle in the way of absorbing the equipment was another thing, and this was a very critical factor that we had to keep in mind, and that during the program, if, let's say, the MAG and the country team concluded that they were not up to it, then the delivery of equipment should be phased down accordingly. I think it's pretty important. Maybe the thing we do is take a minute on this point. Mm-hmm. And that is the question of the feeling, perception in the West that the Shah was overly certainly overly anxious, but overly, you know, just charmed by the idea of what advanced equipment can do for them. Charm is not the problem, but at least there was that factor. And he certainly quizzed everybody that came out to Iran about this type of equipment and so on. But I think a fundamental factor is that you have to look back on the number of times Iran had been invaded, or if you will, entered by a foreign power, particularly the British and the Russians, and that he felt very strongly that it was his obligation as the head of the country to see that the forces had the best possible equipment. It became very clear as during the 70s and even during the time I was there that his concept did not envisage being able to defend Iran against an all-out Soviet attack, but that he did want to have enough there to stop some entry, the country being overrun, enough to stop it, he referred to it as a lock on the door, so that that could then trigger a mechanism in the UN or US commitments under CENTO and so on.
During this period, though, when you were involved in this mission in 1962, how much concern was there about the possibility of a Soviet military attack? Or was it more of a regional problem that were considered to be serious?
I think that, well, and I think that we questioned whether the regional problem was as serious as he did. I don't think that I don't think anybody, I don't know about it, it's wrong, but felt that the Soviets were after invading Iran. After all, they'd had the problems at the end of World War II. At that time, question of the nuclear delivery capability was still our deterrent was still a pretty effective one in contrast to what's happened since then.
Before we get back to some of the military questions, what was your sense of, at this time, if you can recall, what was your sense of the Shah's position in this country in the early 60s? How secure do you think his position was in the early 60s?
I think that there were the incidents in 63, and there were indications that there were problems. I frankly would like to kind of hold on that one until I've had a chance to check something. But it was recognized by the country team and everybody else concerned that it was a very brittle situation.
Now you mentioned the Iranian chief of staff. Iranian chief of staff. General
Hedges.
Who were some of the other military figures that you worked with on the Iranian side?
We met with the three services. I guess our principal contact was General Afkami, and he's the one that we arranged all of our meetings with, trips with, and so on. And then we visited, the team visited the various installations in the area. The Air Force representative, we went particularly to check all of the air installations. We had the Navy captain and I went down to Abadan and Gulf.
Let me turn this over. It's going to run.